We're learning our special series on the building the Jewish home, Binyan HaBayit. And we had ended off last week with the discussion of the different terms that Chazal use for describing marriage. We began with Tov LaGever Ki Yisa Ol Binurav. Ol Torah, Ol Isha, Ol Melacha. The verse says in Eicha, Lamentations, Tov LaGever, it's good for the man, Ki Yisa Ol Binurav, that he should take on a yoke when he's young. And what yoke is it speaking about? So our sages said it means the yoke of Torah, means the yoke of a wife, and it means the yoke of work. You get married, so the Gemara says you're going to have Parnasa, and obviously your learning is going to go down to an extent. There's no other way about it. The Gemara says that there were different customs between the Rabbanim in the Talmud's time in Israel and the sages in Babylon. Some would say learn Torah first and then get married, because once you get married, you're going to have to work, support your wife, support your family. You're not going to be able to learn the way you should. Some said, no, get married first, and then your learning will be better. We discussed the learning is better if you're married. So they said, get married, and then you'll be able to learn. And the Gemara says that they had the custom that they used to leave the house for years at a time to go learn. So even though they were married, they were able to learn well. So a person is supposed to take on these yokes when he's young. The yoke of Torah, the yoke of a wife, and the yoke of work. It's interesting that when a child is born, so after 8 days, we give the boy circumcision. And then we have a custom, which goes back to the time of the Gemara. We have a custom to wish the father that he should marry to bring the child in. The Torah, the Chuppah, the Ma'asim Tovim. So we see that Torah came before Chuppah. So you could say, yeah, chronologically, from the time he's 5 years old, you're teaching him Torah. From the time he starts talking, you're teaching him Torah. But there's also the aspect where you're going to get a different level of concentration in your learning before you're married. As much as guys think they have troubles now, this roommate's getting on their nerves, they can't find the chavrusa, they gotta lose weight, they gotta get a shidduch, they gotta get a date, they gotta, I don't know, they gotta juggle 100 things. Should they make aliyah? When should they make aliyah? After you get married, the yoke and the troubles, the things that a person is focused on, the things that a person has to take care of, are much more than before he gets married. Rabbi Feinstein once told me, he said, if a person has a child that has fever at home, so even though most kids have fever, they get better, let him try focusing on the Gemara the same way he would when his child is not with fever at home. That's just a small example, but there are hundreds of examples of things that once a person gets married, aside from the actual practical aspect that he is responsible for Parnasa, there are hundreds of things that are going to trouble him. And that's why a person should know that the years that he has before he gets married are years that he should take full advantage of. When a person gets married, so he's going to see that his learning gets better. Even though we just described how practically there are going to be many things that bother the learning, but there's a certain peace of mind that comes with marriage that afterwards a person can learn better. It's true. But practically he's going to have less time and he's going to have other troubles. So it's a balance. On the one hand, a person should invest time in learning as much as he could before he gets married, because he's going to have less things troubling him. But on the other hand, you should also know that after you get married, God willing, your marriage is going to cause you to be a whole person, a person who has more peace at heart, and that in itself opens up the heart to learning. So don't think that after you get married, that's it, it's over. No, after you get married, you got to attain a new level of learning. And then you'll have the hardships of marriage. But that's normal, that's life. Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael. We have a Tana quote from the Beis Medrash of Rabbi Yishmael. Ad 20 shana yoshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitzape le'adam matai yisa isha. Till a man is 20 years old, God is, so to speak, sitting and waiting. When is he going to get married? And he's waiting and waiting and... So today, people aren't really ready to get married by 20, most people. The Gemara says in Kiddushin that there are responsibilities that a child has for his parents and there are responsibilities that parents have for their children. One of the responsibilities a father has for his child is to marry him off. And we know a father has to teach his child the parnasa, to teach him how to make a living. He could teach him how to drive, and he could be a cab driver, but some form of living he should teach him. And obviously he should try to teach him something that's convenient, and he can make it easily, and he could learn with it, and it's not a filthy job, but he has an obligation to teach him how to make a living. And he also has an obligation to marry him off, to help him find a wife. And sometimes people think, why should my parents be involved? I'm the one dating. So sometimes our parents are so different from us that it's difficult to involve them. They're going to mess everything up. But most often guys think if I involve them, they'll mess everything up. And it's not always true. And even if you can't involve them practically, so you should at least give them the feeling they're involved. Like one girl once told my brother, she said, if you can't tell him about the date, then spend 10 minutes describing the scene you saw at the date. Describe the tree you sat next to. Don't describe the girl, but give them a feeling like they're there. Figure out a different way to make them feel good about it. That's part of bringing a child up. We just mentioned that you wish the parents, they should bring up the child, the Torah, l'chuppah, l'maisim tovim. Part of bringing them up is to the chuppah. So they should at least have a feeling they're involved in it. Sometimes, unfortunately, today it's very common that kids only tell their parents they're dating or they're about to get married when they meet Mrs. Wright and they say, look, I'm going to get engaged in a day or two, or worse, I just got engaged. It's not right. Why should the parents get it that way? You should involve them. So I know a guy that when he hit his third date with his wife, so he told his parents he started dating her. And when he hit the fifth, so he told them he hit the third. You don't have to keep him up to date. Every girl you start going out with, the whole family's going to talk about it. I know the problem. You tell your parents you just got a good offer, and the next day the whole family's gossiping about the girl you're about to marry when you haven't even gone out on date number one. So fine, I'm not saying you have to involve them with every girl, but you definitely should have them involved along the way. And being that this is a class not about being sons, but it's a class about being parents and getting married, so keep in mind that soon, God willing, you're all going to be parents, and a little further down the road, your children are going to start dating. So know to keep your nose out. You help them, but you could, but be careful. You don't want to sway them the wrong way. It's a lot of responsibility thinking with the kid. You have to put yourself in their shoes as much as you can and think with them. You have to be available. The Medrash says, the Torah taught us from the fact that Avram was getting old and his wife passed away and he worries about marrying off his son Yitzchak, who's already 40 years old or something. He's an old man. So the Torah taught us that Avram first married off Yitzchak, and then afterward Avram got remarried. He was a widower. He wanted to get remarried. The woman who he wanted to remarry wasn't far away. He could have gotten her at any given moment, but he didn't. First he got his son married, and then he remarried. So the Torah taught us by that if a person has older children, he should marry them first, and then he should worry about marrying himself. Like Avram, first married off his son, then he married himself. It's one of the responsibilities, to marry off a child. Amar Rava, Hanosei Isha Tzarich Sheivdok Be'achea. The Gemara in Bava Basra says, Rava says, when a person marries a woman, he should check out her brothers. Most children are going to be similar to your brother-in-laws. So how does this work? What are you checking when you're checking out the brothers? How long their payas are? The midot, right? The Ran was one of the great sages, one of the great Rishonim. He wasn't only a Rishon, he was one of the greatest Rishonim that were. He was considered like the chief rabbi in his time. So the Ran, Rabbeinu Nisim, is printed in the back of many Masechtos, his commentary on the Rif. The Ran wrote a series of speeches, Drashos Aran. And in one of them he discusses why is it that we find that the Avos, the patriarchs, they sent away to marry from their own family. When they come to their own family, they find that their family is serving idols. And they know their family is serving idols. Abraham, Avram, when he leaves his family, he leaves his father serving idols. Yitzchak, he knows his grandfather was an idol worshiper, and he's going to take Rivka, whose father, Besuel, is an idol worshiper. So what difference does it make if they're serving idols back in Padan Aram or they're serving idols in the land of Canaan? Why were they so interested in getting a girl from their own family? What's the difference? So the Ran explains that when one marries a person, so that person is bringing with them things from the home. Every person has an obligation to build themselves. But we all have a starting point. And the starting point regarding our traits, regarding our midot, regarding our characteristics, how we treat people, that's going to come from the home. And the forefathers knew that their homes were homes of kindness. When Eliezer, Avram's servant, comes out to Padan Aram, so he's invited in. And he finds a girl that automatically offers him a drink and offers to help him with the camels. So the forefathers knew that they might end up with wives who were idol worshippers. But they also knew that the midos would be good. And when it comes to a person's beliefs, when it comes to a person's philosophy, that's something you could discuss. That's not so ingrained. You could discuss with an intelligent person and convince them and explain to them there is only one God, and he's the one running the show. You can't serve the sun. Look, the sun disappears at night. You can't serve the moon. The moon disappears at night. What's the moon? Try talking to the moon. Don't serve the grass. The grass could be mowed. Don't serve the rain. You could speak to a person, philosophy. You could explain the logic. But when it comes to a person's traits, so even though every person has to work on their traits, and people can and do improve, but there's a starting point, and you want to marry a person whose starting point is very high. And that's why the forefathers searched for a woman specifically from their families, which they knew their families were people with good traits. And when you're checking out a girl, so it pays to hear who her siblings are. Are they people who are involved with helping the public? Are they people who care about people? It pays to check out who her parents are too. But at the end of the day, you have to remember that Rivka had a brother whose name was Lavan. And Yitzchak still married her. So these are recommendations. If you're offered a girl, this is a good thing to check out. If you have two girls, and one of them is a girl that has brothers who are fine people, so that's a plus on her side. Now, obviously, you want her to be a fine person too. I mean, she's a witch and they're fine people. You didn't gain anything. But one way of knowing is checking out the siblings. Huh?
So the way around, if the parents are
It depends on what. So that's why I stressed. I don't think over here that you have to focus necessarily on the Torah aspect, on the aspect of are they keeping Shabbos. Maybe they don't know about Shabbos. But maybe they're people who give a lot to charity. Maybe they're people who do the best they can in the given circumstances.
Yeah, I didn't mean like doing mitzvahs. I mean like other things, like midot wise.
So midot, this is a recommendation. If you have a fantastic girl and everything else is not fantastic, so it's something to weigh, but it's not necessarily a reason not to marry her. You have to remember that fine people came out of bad homes. Rivka came out of a bad home. And lousy people came out of good homes. Esav came out of a great home, the same home that Yaakov came out of. So this isn't a formula that says this is how you marry a girl. This is one recommendation, one way of checking out a girl. It's one aspect. So?
You won't meet until the wedding.
Yes, I believe you should check them out. I told my wife that all the time when we were dating. I said, check out my family. It's not enough you see me. What do you know where I come from? And practically, it's more than that. It's not just a question of what Chazal recommended, that your children are going to be like your wife's siblings. But practically, if a person grew up in a certain atmosphere, chances are they're going to reproduce it in their own home. Even though people do have reactions, and that they say, I'm going to do the exact opposite in my own home. There's a saying that says, if you want to know what this girl's going to, who you're going to be married to 20 years down the road, look at your mother-in-law. So there's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot, I haven't been married 20 years yet. But I have experience with a lot of people, and there's a lot of truth to that. As much as a person can work on themselves, when the chips fall, usually when people blow up, the first thing that happens is they replay a scene that they've seen in their own home. And even in the fashion in which people argue and discipline and treat their kids and treat their spouse, usually they're recreating what they've seen at home. A person can decide on certain points that they're going to change what they've seen at home. And a person should always improve on what they saw at home, and a person shouldn't let this happen. And the first step is to be cognizant of the fact that the tendency is that it does happen. but it's very hard to do it. And chances are that without noticing how a person does it, a person will do it. And that's why it's a great asset when a person can find a good home. Doesn't mean that that's the only family you should marry into, but it's definitely an asset, and it's definitely something to think about if the home is not a good home, or if there are great arguments between the future son-in-law and the parents-in-law, meaning if they're saying, the guy's a wacko, he went to Machon Meir, don't marry a guy like that, that's a problem. You can't disregard that. That's something that sometimes people have to live with their whole lives, and it takes its toll. Now, I'm not saying that's a reason to break a shidduch. I'm just saying don't disregard that. It's not nothing.
Nothing's nothing, right?
Certain things are nothing. When guys tell me she cooks well, in my book, that's nothing. I don't care if she cooks well. When guys tell me she dresses well, so you'll go buy her clothes with her. Like if she doesn't dress well. There are things that in my book are nothing. I didn't say she's good looking. Good looking is something. Her looks is something that has to appeal to you. But how she dresses, so you want her to put on makeup, you'll talk about it. You want her to wear a wig, you'll talk about it. That I don't think are issues.
People grow up in broken homes, and they, eventually, but I'm just saying, some people grow up with broken, in broken homes and very lousy childhood, and they grow up and they learn study Torah, and then they, but I mean, if someone would see that, they wouldn't be impressed. I mean.
So I think that a person has to know that if it goes two ways. When I was dating, I asked my rabbis this question: should I go out with a girl from a broken home? Isn't that going to be her default? And their response was that not necessarily. Sometimes it goes the other way around. A person who saw a broken home sometimes says the last thing in the world that's ever going to happen is I'm going to have a broken home.
Right.
On the other hand, I could tell you guys who learned in the Machon, who came back to me after they were married, and they told me that every time it gets tough in the home, the first thing they think is we should get divorced because they grew up in a home that broke. Because what they've seen in their home is that when things go tough, so okay, you break up. That's the default in their mind. Now, does that mean that one shouldn't go out with a girl that's divorced? No. That means that a person has to know if he comes from such a home or if he's going to go out with a girl from such a home, that's something that has to be worked on. And that's one of the points I wanted to discuss today, that there are a few things that have truly shaken the Jewish home. And they come from the Western culture. One is the concept of divorce. We discussed in our first class that the major enemy of the engagement period and then the first year or the first few years is the thought, maybe this wasn't right. And you'll be surprised that the average person who gets engaged has that thought. The men, during the engagement period, it's most common that a guy's going to think, did I do right? Sometimes guys don't get engaged because of that. Because they think, how do I know for sure? Maybe there's something better out there. And the problem is when it persists through marriage or when it causes a guy to break up an engagement for no good reason, a person has to know that it's natural and it's normal. And a person has to be mind over emotion, mind over matter. Yeah, you have to control it and say, no, that's not going to enter the marriage. No marriage can last under the scrutiny of an eye that's questioning whether the marriage is worth lasting. Because then every little point just adds up. Whereas if you approach it and say, this is it. If I married her, that means that I was meant to marry her. That's what God had in mind. 40 years before I was created in my mother's womb, 40 days before I was created, the heavenly voice came out and said, I'm going to marry her. So now things are tough, so we're going to make it work. That has to be the attitude, and there's no other way about it. And if a person comes from a broken home, he has to work on himself all the more that has to be the attitude. And sometimes when I sit with Chassanim, I deliberate with myself. On the one hand, you want to explain to the Chassan how beautiful a Jewish home is, and that all the serenity and the beauty and the joy and the happiness of a person's life is going to stem from that home. On the other hand, you also want him to be prepared that the most beautiful home and the greatest home is that beautiful home together with its hardships. There's no such thing as a home that things run smoothly. It's a facade. You go to people's houses and you see the wife smiling and the husband smiling and everything going well. That's true. It's true that things go well. But it's also true that things aren't always smiling and things aren't always so hunky-dory. And that this is true in everyone's home. There's no couple that hasn't had serious arguments and hasn't had times when one pained the other and they have to work things out. There's no such thing. And as much as I tell it to Hasanim, they still come back to me afterwards and they're broken. And I tell them, you think when I said it was going to be hard, I meant hard like a roommate getting on your nerves? When everyone tells you it's hard, they mean it's harder than anything you've ever had. It's hard. It's much harder than anything else. And that's not abnormal. The reason I tell people this before they get married is because there's such a strong inclination for divorce today. And couples are discussing divorce before they've lived together half a year. It's not right. The fact that it's hard means it's a normal marriage. And that now, to make it good, that takes work. The first few years is work. Afterwards is work. Your whole life is work. You're also going to enjoy it. But if you think when you're looking around and the other couples you see are smiling and everything's going good, they're not working at it, there's no such thing. If you're ready to get married, it means you're ready to work on building a marriage. No marriage lasts on its own. We know the famous story, the Roman, there was a woman who was a high official in Rome, and she went to, I think it was Rabbi Gamliel, and she asked him, what's God doing since he created the world? And he told her, God's making shidduchim. So she said, that's what God's busy with? The world's running and that's what God has to do? I can do that. She called in her servants and she started making matches. She said, you live with her, you live with her, you live with her, you live with her. And she said, look, I can do that. I can be like God. So he said, okay, let's see. A few days later, this one comes in. She bashed his head. That one comes in. And she sees that none of the shidduchim are working. So she comes back to him and she says, yeah, that's a really smart answer you told me, that's what God's busy doing. Every couple was messed up, didn't work. So there's a saying, I don't know who said it. We think that when he told her that God's matching couples, it means a new shidduch. Everyone wants to get married, so he's finding the right match for this guy, this girl. Doesn't mean that. It means that, and then it also means every couple that's married, every morning God has to make it work again. God's again making that couple, matching that couple all over again, because it needs God's intervention. So people have to be prepared to work on it. And the fact that a person comes from a broken home doesn't mean he can't build a beautiful home. A person can build a beautiful home and should build a beautiful home.
You're saying, look at the family, and the family's not going to technically want to say anything to you.
That's true. But if you have, I'm saying, if you have two options, then... No, it's an asset to have a family that is a positive family. Does that mean that you should turn down any offer that isn't that way? No. You have to weigh all aspects. If the person is an exceptional person and many other positive factors, so you could decide that outweighs it. And that might be a perfectly legitimate decision. Look, Moshe Rabbeinu's parents were divorced twice. They got divorced when the decree came out to throw all the sons into the Nile. And then when the Torah was given, they had to get divorced again because they were forbidden to be married, Moshe Rabbeinu's parents. Amram had married his aunt, and a person could marry his niece, but he can't marry his aunt. So if you're going to say that divorce means a person's a bad person, then the greatest person in the world, well, his parents were divorced twice. So I'm not saying that a person can't be a tremendous person that's worth marrying and that you should jump and try to catch because the parents are divorced. I'm just saying that the fact that a person comes from a broken home or what we were discussing more specifically is the traits of the family. Those are going to be assets if they're positive, and there's something to consider if they're not. Yeah?
So you said that you started with divorce as one of the things that's like weakening the Jewish house today? Are there other specific things, or you just want to...
So one point was the concept of divorce.
Yeah.
Another point that weakens the Jewish home, thank you for bringing me back to that. There's another point today. And that is how people enter marriage. And it's especially true with people who are chozer b'tshuva. Unfortunately, it's becoming true for the whole crowd. People are entering marriage with completely Western concepts, and their expectations from marriage are completely Western. People are thinking that marriage revolves around romance, and people are thinking that marriage revolves around having a good time and having a nice car and having a wife that you could show off wherever you go, and focusing on outside the home instead of inside the home. And inside the home, the house is where you're going to watch TV, the house is where you're going to invite your friends, and the house is where there's going to be romance. Well, Judaism doesn't say there isn't romance. And it is an important part of marriage, but it's not the focus of marriage. It's a tool. It's something which is a tool that the couple use for expressing their love to one another. But it's not an end, it's a means. It's a means for God's entering the house. We say that when a couple is together, then God is with them. That means that we look at the concept of a couple being together as something holy. It's not something I'm coming in to have a good time. People enter marriage thinking, yeah, great, I have a wife, so I'm going to have a good time. Yeah, you're going to have a good time, but that's not the focus. And the focus is building the home. The focus is giving. When a person enters marriage, he has to be prepared to give and give and give, and he also has to be prepared to give some more. Marriage is about giving. The day a person starts thinking, well, what am I getting for it? That's the day the happiness in his marriage ends. A person has to enter marriage and continue throughout married life with the approach that, what am I here? I'm here to give. I'm here to give pleasure. I'm here to give happiness. My job is to support the household. That has to be the husband's approach, and that has to be the wife's approach. And the person can't start thinking, well, is she coming with that approach? What about her? You know, I'm doing everything here. I'm the one cleaning the dishes. I'm the one taking out the garbage. I'm the one cleaning the floor. I'm the one doing all the work. I work all day. I'm bringing the parnasa. What's she doing? The day a person starts thinking like that is the day the happiness has left the marriage. Now, it's true. A person at any given point in time could start thinking, well, I'm giving a lot more than she's giving. Usually it's not true. And even when it is true, what are you going to gain by thinking that way? What are you going to gain with that approach? You entered marriage, that means you were prepared to give. You obviously expect to receive certain things. But that receiving has to come through discussion, and we're going to discuss other ways. But the approach has to be, what can I give? So that means when there's the garbage to be taken out, person's first thought should be, well, can I go take it out now? Not, why should I be the one taking it out? Even people who are learning, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach used to be very upset when he saw their wives carrying and them not carrying. And a person doesn't want to hold by the Eruv, so then the wife is the one pushing the carriage up the hill. Well, he didn't like that. Halachically, so you don't want to hold by the Eruv, you have to figure out a solution. But for her to be the one pushing the carriage, that's a problem. same thing is true with carrying things. And it goes for every aspect of married life. The Gemara says, "Kol hanoseh isha ksheira ki'ilu kiyem kol ha'torah merosh ve'atzof, ve'alav hu omer eshtecha kegefen poriyah." Whoever marries a kosher woman, it's as though he kept the whole Torah. It doesn't mean you don't have to keep everything, but it means that that's so valued in God's eyes that a person marries a kosher woman, it's as though he kept the whole Torah, and that's what about such a person the verse states, your wife is going to be like a grapevine that gives fruits. Hanose isha hogenet lo. If a person marries a woman that's fit for him, Eliyahu noshko, Eliyahu comes and kisses him, v'akadosh baruch hu avo, and God loves him. Now what does it mean, isha hogenet lo, a woman that's fit for him? So, that's up for interpretation. Our sages say that there were times when our sages gave counsel to people, and they told the person, don't marry a woman who's too much older than you. Don't marry a woman who's too much younger than you. Our sages said a person shouldn't marry a woman for her money. If he does, then they promised him that he won't get to enjoy that money. There's a promise from our sages that a person who marries a woman solely for her money will not enjoy that money. I think that there's another aspect to be discussed here. Sometimes when I ask guys, what are they looking for? So they say, I'm looking like everyone else. I'm looking for the perfect girl. You're laughing. You'd be surprised how often I get that line. I think that's a mistake. I contain myself from asking them, are you the perfect guy? Why do you think the perfect girl is good for you? We have to realize that we're not perfect.
One is perfect, not perfect.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. I tell them, I always say, you need the girl that's perfect for you. That's what the Midrash here is saying. Yeah, if a person marries Isha Hogenet Lo, a woman that's fit for him, you don't need a woman who's perfect, that she can run the household, everything's spick and span, everything's neat, and she, I don't know what else she can do, and she's beautiful, and she knows all the Torah and whatever. Yeah, you won't feel at home there. You're going to walk in and take off your shoes, and she's going to look, and you smudged the floor I just cleaned. And then you're going to sit down to make a bracha, and she's going to think, gee, don't you know the halacha? You're supposed to put on a hat before you make a kiddush, and that wouldn't be good for you. You don't need the perfect girl, assuming that's a perfect girl. Who says the perfect girl is one who knows the whole Torah? Whatever. But however you'll describe her, no one needs the perfect girl because no one's the perfect guy. Every person needs the girl that's perfect for him. What does that mean? We had a guy who couldn't take care of anything. He was a doctor and he was balagan. He didn't know where his keys were. He had to take medication. He didn't have his medication with him. The guy needed medication, but he wouldn't remember to take it. She'd remind him on the dates. This girl would remind him before the dates. She'd call him to remind him to bring his medication along. Everything was balagan. Didn't know where anything was. And he knew he needed a girl that would make his life mesuda. She would put everything in order. So he found the girl. They got married. And then a few months after the marriage, things were going tough. And he told me one time, he said, you know, she demands that everything be in order. I don't get it. So I asked him, I said, I don't understand. You're upset that she gets upset when you make a balagan in the whole house, but she cleans the whole house, right? She's the one that keeps everything in order. She's the one that's paying the bills. Thanks to her, you have electric, right? Thanks to her, you have a phone line, because you wouldn't be paying your bills, right? That's true. She's the one that's running everything. You wanted a girl like this. So now you're saying she's like this, but there's this small aspect where she actually wants me to change a little bit, where she actually says, I can't clean the whole house day after you, and the second later you mess everything up. You have to a little bit come towards me. So that's unreasonable? What'd you want? You wanted a slob like you? Then it wouldn't work. You didn't want that. So you're willing to take the positive sides of having a woman who's going to arrange your life. But when she tries to have you on time for your dentist appointment, she tries to have you on time for weddings that you're responsible for being there, and she tries to arrange everything right, and it sort of impedes on your schedule because you want to continue your life your own way, then you're upset that it doesn't work. You wanted a girl that's going to make everything organized. So you can't say, I wanted that aspect of it, but not a different aspect of it. So she's perfect for him. But he's willing to think, yeah, she's perfect, but. There's no but. And the same thing is true on many, many, many fronts. Most of the time, when people think their wife this or that, if they think it through, they'd recognize that it's part of a trait which they desperately needed in their wife. And it's a small thing you're not even giving in on. It's not a point that you're giving in on. It's part of what you need. And people have to get that perspective. Do we need to give another example, or did you get what I meant? I think you, yeah. Okay. So I think that's what we have to remember, that the Medrash said, if a man marries a woman that's fit for him, and what's fit for me isn't what's fit for you, and what's fit for you isn't what's fit for the next guy. A perfect wife is the wife that's perfect for the person she's married to. I think that now we'll go over to some general points. We discussed last week the importance of expressing admiration, the importance of, we discussed appreciation, and the idea that everyone in marriage needs to feel appreciated, and that this is what people fall short on most of the time, showing appreciation, especially to the wife. We discussed how the wife's job is described like a tanner's job. It's a job where everyone needs hides, everyone needs shoes, but people step on their shoes and they don't even appreciate the shoes they're wearing. And the wife, she cooks and cleans. You eat what she cooks, and the next day she has to cook all over again. She cleans, gets a mess, she has to start all over again. It's a thankless job, everything a woman does. It's something that it's very hard to point a finger to. Women, especially today, that people are pushing careers so much, very often a woman, after she's brought up all her kids, ran a fantastic home, and her kids are all successes, she looks and she says, what have I been doing for the last 20 years? And society looks at her and asks her, do you work? Of course she works. Who runs the house? No such thing as a non-working woman. If she doesn't have a job, then she's really working building the home. So appreciation for the wife is something that you can never give enough of. Our sages say that when Abraham, on the third day after he was circumcised, he was sitting at the entrance to his tent. He was dying for guests, and there were no guests coming. So the Torah tells us there were three angels. He ran towards the angels. They came to the entrance of the tent. They sat down under a tree to eat. And they asked him, Ayei Sarai Ishtecha, where is Sarah your wife? So Rashi quotes from Chazal that Sarah, they knew, they were angels. They knew she was in the tent. But they wanted him to appreciate that she's such a modest woman that even though she's preparing the food and the food is coming out to the guests, she's modest and she's inside and they don't even see her. So you ask yourself, you're talking about Avram Avinu, the father of kindness. Avram is chesed, right? If he was kind to everyone outside, like we discussed in our first class, in Judaism we measure a person by how he is at home. That's the first measurement. So you could be sure that Avram was reaping with kindness to his wife. And yet the angels saw a point to stress that Sarah is a tznua, that she's at home, so that Avram will appreciate her. You think he didn't appreciate that she was a tznua? He knew she was a tznua. But even Avram Avinu, there was a point where he could be strengthened in his appreciation for his wife. So if Avram Avinu could be strengthened, I think we could all appreciate that we'll all also be able to be strengthened. I often believe that couples should take on a challenge for themselves. Take a month where every day you write a different note of appreciation to your wife. Try it. If it gets hard, then you see you're not appreciating your wife. I have a friend who, Baruch Hashem, has many children. And not long ago, his wife was pregnant. And towards the end of the pregnancy, she miscarried. And he was devastated. A very, very kind person. And it devastated him. And he decided from that day on that every time he davens Shmoneh Esrei, when he reaches Modim, he's going to stop and think of a new thing to thank God for. He said, there are so many things we don't appreciate. I had so many children that were healthy. Did I really appreciate every child that was born healthy? And he said, that's not enough. Every day I have to stop before Modim, before I say the prayer where I thank God for what he's given me, I'm going to think of another point that I haven't thanked God yet for. That was his reaction after his wife miscarried. And I think that this is definitely true for God, and it's also true to our wives. A person can always find new things to appreciate. And if he can't, then that's another sign that he's not appreciating enough. We said one of the points in the home that people have to recognize is the need for independence. Now there are two needs that every person has that are conflicting. One is independence, and the other is to be close. In English today they call it the intimacy versus autonomy struggle. We need intimacy. We need autonomy. We all need to be close. We all need our privacy. And there are different balances. Some people need more intimacy. Some people need more autonomy. But everyone needs both. And when you get close to someone, if you have a friend, and suddenly he starts asking you about why you didn't wake up for Shacharis, you're going to feel he's overstepping his bounds. This is too intimate. If you have a friend and you walk into the room after you've had a really tough day and you look finished and he doesn't ask you anything, he's minding his own business, you're going to feel he's giving you too much autonomy. What's the balance? So that's something that different cultures have different balances and different people have different balances. In marriage, this comes up all the time. Wives naturally need more intimacy than men. Men naturally need more autonomy than women. Those are two different points. They need more intimacy than we do. What does that mean? That means that a husband could be on the phone and he just answers the phone and he starts talking and his wife says, "Who is that?" And he's thinking, "Does she want me to stop talking and answer her? Is that what she wants?" Yeah, that's what she wants. That's what she wants. How come you start... Internally, she's feeling, I want to be part of everything he's doing. The husband, the first thing he's thinking is, what's going on here? Is this normal? Yes, it's normal. I'm giving you this example because it's a classic example. So now you're prepared. When you'll be on the phone and your wife is going to ask you some questions, so you should be... You want life as you know it to be over. You have to be prepared to say just a second and answer. And not get upset over it. Understand where it's coming from. It's because she loves you. I have a feeling that you guys think I'm extreme. And I have a feeling that you guys think I'm exaggerating. So I would appreciate it if you ask some married people. Don't take my word for it. And you know what? It doesn't really matter. So long as you remember it when you get married. If it doesn't happen in your home, hinei mato. If it does happen in your home, just make sure it's manaim. Just make sure that you take it pleasantly and you're happy with it. Husbands usually live their own lives, or to an extent are happy living their own lives. For a husband, getting married means I have someone to come home, someone's going to cook and clean, and I could share certain things that I want to share with her, but I'm going to keep my own privacy. The autonomy by men is number one. In a survey of a bunch of professors, they asked them why they chose their job. So the number one thing that they all stressed was the fact that they have independence too. One has independence to further his studies. One has independence to have certain days off to do what he wants. One has independence to have students help him out with his research projects. A tremendous percentage, the first thing that they listed why they chose that profession was independence. Men are very focused on independence. Call it power, call it independence. It revolves around independence. And women are focused on intimacy. We discussed how for a woman, speech is an expression of intimacy. Just speaking to someone. And we discussed how it doesn't matter what we're talking about. The important thing is that we're connecting. In a home, a husband has a responsibility to make his wife happy. Now that means that you have to be prepared for a higher level of intimacy than you're prepared for. A higher level of intimacy than you would want. How much more? So you don't kill yourself. But you do have to be prepared to give more than you would give on your own. What does that mean? That means that you share with your wife certain things that happen during your day that you wouldn't ordinarily. Sometimes you'll find yourself telling someone on the phone one of the things that annoys wives most. Is when suddenly they hear you speaking on the phone that the boss was speaking to you about a raise. You didn't tell her yet. How didn't you tell me? You finished a perek in Gemara. And you didn't tell her yet. So for men, well, what do you care? No, it's not what do you care. I want to be part of everything you do. For the wife, she wants to feel like she's a part of everything. And it's her expression of love. It's because she is so connected to her husband that she wants to be part of everything. It's because of that when he's on the phone, she wants to know who he's talking to, or if he said something, she'll ask him or comment on it. It's not because she's a nudnik. Again, it's not because she's a nudnik. It's because that she wants to connect with her husband. And that's a blessing. You have to just be prepared to view it as such and be prepared to adapt it. One area where this comes up very acutely is when, you know, sometimes it does happen that there is an argument. Sometimes it happens that that argument is pretty harsh. So we're going to play out the scenario. They finish the argument. They finish. He says what he has to say. She says what she has to say. So finally says, okay, I need a break. They call it, I think, he wants to go to his cave. He says, okay, let me go. I'll think about it. We'll talk. I'll be back in a half hour. She says, it's not enough. Everything you said to me until now, now you're going to leave me? He says, what do you mean? It's not enough everything you said until now? You want us to continue? Where are we going to get? We said everything that has to be said. Well, what do we need to talk for anymore? Let me go think. You're leaving? You get the picture? The right after there's an argument, she desperately needs intimacy. She needs reassuring that she is loved, that everything's okay, we'll work this out. She can't have him taking his autonomy. He feels this intimacy has brought all this on. I need my autonomy. Let me out. Well, I'll get back, but let me out. I think you guys understand that, yeah? Okay. So you have to be prepared for that. And the question is, who gives in? So there are two approaches. One of my teachers once said, whoever is more at fault should be the one to give in. This is a concept that they should discuss, and they should... And they should recognize who's more at fault, and they should give in. I don't believe in that. My approach is you guys give in. You didn't marry in order to have someone else give in to you. So it's difficult. You be the one to give in. You could say, you know, I just got to go to the bathroom. If you feel like you really have to calm down, that's a good hiding place. Go to the bathroom, calm down. You didn't run away. Walking out the door is a big no-no. Walking out the door is something that hurts terribly. Walking into your own room, so again, you have to remember where she's coming from. Now, we're speaking in general terms because that's the only way we could speak. Obviously, there will be an instance where she might not want intimacy right now. Fine, I'm not discussing that. We're speaking in general. 99% of the times, what's going to happen is she's going to want the intimacy. The intimacy could be to sit down over a cup of coffee and talk. You might feel like, I can't really talk to you right now. So you have to figure out what to do. But my approach is, you're the gentleman, and you got married, so she's your responsibility. Your responsibility to make her happy. You be the one to give in. I don't go with the approach of that teacher, but I don't know. If you could figure out a way of making it work, obviously what he's saying is logical. I just don't see how it's practical. We mentioned the Gemara in Ksubos about the husband whose wife tried to make his life miserable. And what did he do? Everywhere he went, he would bring her something. That's something to remember. Again, it's the same concept. I'm always thinking of you. She has a difficult test coming up. She has something important coming up. Then you should call and find out how it's going. If you're going to be out of the house during the day, you guys aren't going to meet for lunch. So it's a nice thing to call sometime during the day. Should every person make a habit of it? I don't know. I don't know how to give guidance for every person. But why not? Why today? Why shouldn't, if a husband could, if he has a lunch break that's long enough and he has the time, why shouldn't he show her that affection and call her sometime during the day? It's very difficult to get off the phone. You call and you start talking And she doesn't want it to end. Now that's understandable. We've explained that. So I always say that Chachame Einav Berosho, right? The verse says that a wise person, his eyes are in his head. He's prepared to foresee what's going to happen. So be prepared that that's going to happen. And set it up in a way that you're not the one pulling away. What does that mean? That means that you could call 2 minutes before they start davening Ma'ariv. So you call and you talk, and then they're about to start Baruch Hu. You didn't end the conversation. You think I'm laughing. I'm not joking. I'm very serious. There's a big difference between saying, honey, I gotta go. I gotta get back to my job. You know, we've been talking for 20 minutes. And even if you say it in the nicest way possible, bottom line, what you've expressed is, I want this conversation to end. I've had enough intimacy. And if you have to answer Baruch Hu, if Ma'ariv just began, so it's not you that wants to end the conversation. The conversation has to end because of external factors. For the same reason, it's recommended if you want to learn at night at home, so have a chavrusa come over. If you're going to say, I got to learn now. I got to work now. Or something else. Yeah, okay, she's going to let you work. But there's no wife. I don't care who. She could be the greatest saint in the world that won't stop you 15 times while you're working. I won't stop you 20 times while you're learning. And she's going to tell you 100 times she wants you to learn. And she does want you to learn. But she's also going to stop and ask you where you put the kid's toothbrush. And where you put that magazine. And what should she say to this person that just called? Hundreds of other things. So if you want to express your intimacy and at the same time you need that time, so do it in a way that's wise. If you can go out to Beis Medrash, you have a chavrusa in Beis Medrash, very nice. If you can't do that, then it's recommended to have a chavrusa come to the house. Then you're not the one that wants to end the conversation. The chavrusa just walked in. You have to stop. He's waiting for you. And this is I'm giving two examples, but you have to think how to apply it. It's always recommended that it's not you that wants to pull away. I have a friend whose wife wanted desperately that he should be a big Talmud Chacham. She wanted it so badly that during Sheva Brachos, they were just married. She kicked him out of the house. She said, I didn't marry you to sit around here. I married you to be a big Talmud Chacham. Go learn. I know of a rabbi who calls her a Meshugana. She's crazy. But she's Meshugana in a good way. So she's an exceptional person. You can't expect that they're 1 in 10 million. And I wish them luck. I mean, she needs a special husband, obviously. So she got a special husband. But that husband once told me, he said, the key to being able to learn is that your wife always feel like you prefer being with her. So long as she feels that you would prefer being with her, then she could send you out and say, go learn. The second she feels you'd rather be out there learning or working, if that's what it is, or something else, then it's competition. So then she's competing with your work. So then she automatically needs to feel more intimacy. Now that's a key for many, many things in life. The woman has to feel she's number one. She should be number one. But sometimes number two has to come in too. You know, you do have a job. You do have to work. You do have to learn. So the key is that you have to express, and expressing means that she feels it. People sometimes say, I express so much appreciation. I don't believe anyone else does as much as I do. I leave 15 notes a day, and I call 3 times a day, and I bring flowers twice a week, whatever. The key is, it doesn't matter how much you do. It's measured by how much she feels it. And you have to do enough that she feels it. If for her, it's not enough until you buy her a diamond ring, so you have to figure out how to buy her a diamond ring. If that's reasonable. She has to feel like she's number one. Our sages said that, I was asked to repeat comments because people on the internet can't hear what was said. So someone commented that it's pretty materialistic.
Pretty materialistic.
Michal, don't do that. They see you on the video. And our girls listening to this too. Our sages say that before a holiday, one has to buy his wife nice clothing, and he has to buy her jewelry, whatever he could afford. That's how he's going to make her happy for the regal. So you'd say, okay, that's the average woman. But a pious woman who wants her husband to learn Torah, she's not going to want that. So our sages record a conversation between Rabbi Akiva and his wife. And Rabbi Akiva told her that one day, they were very, very poor, he was plucking hay out of her hair. They were sleeping in hay. They couldn't afford a bed. He promised her that one day he'd get her Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. There was an ornament that they wore, like a crown over their hair, that... Like, what's it called? Girls wear it today?
Tiara?
I don't know. I don't know what that is. I guess it's like a crown, which had Jerusalem in gold. And he told her that he wishes one day he could get it for her. So we see that even a great wife, like Rabbi Akiva's wife, most of the Torah that we have today is thanks to her. Because she's the one that got him to learn. And he's the one that sustained the Torah Shabbat, the oral law. And where would we be without that? So that's thanks to her. And this righteous woman gave up 24 years of her life living with her husband. Now, she was the second wife at least, second or third. He was married beforehand. And this woman was promised something, which he kept the promise. He did get her that beautiful ornament. And we see that he understood that was important for her. So she could give up for 24 years to live without her husband, but still she appreciated that ornament. I think that the idea is not so much the ornament as what's behind it. It's what the husband's expressing when he gives it.
Right.
And there's also the aspect that every person wants to look good, and a woman all the more so. That's part of the blessing that God gave her, that she's her looks. I don't think one has to look down upon it. And one also has to remember that the husband appreciates when his wife decorates himself. He appreciates when she's all dressed up and she's looking good. So she wants to do that. She wants to be good looking for him. It's a positive thing that God instilled in women. And our sages say that we have different measurements that are considered measurements of importance. Meaning, we're not allowed to carry things from private domain to public domain on Shabbos. But you have to carry a substantial amount in order to be chayav. What's a substantial amount? So our sages give measurements for different things. They say, what's a substantial amount of eyeshadow? So they say, enough eyeshadow to put on one eye. So the Gemara asks, which woman walks around with eyeshadow on only one eye? So the Gemara says, those very, very tzanua women who cover themselves up, like the Arab women cover themselves up, they wear head coverings and face coverings, they're all covered up, but they leave one eye revealed, they got to see where they're going. That eye, they wear eyeshadow on. So you think, if she's such a tzanua woman, the Gemara calls her a tzanua, she's wearing eyeshadow on the one eye she's revealing? Yes, a tzanua woman, the one eye she's revealing is going to have eyeshadow on. And that's positive. It's not to be looked down upon, it's to be looked up upon. That's positive. She's supposed to be good looking for her husband.
It's a pressure of someone who doesn't, like Rabbi Akiva, who doesn't have any money sleeping in the...
So I wanted to get to that. It doesn't say that she pressured him. It says that he told her he wants to do it, and that's another important thing that we have
to
learn. Wait.
One, sure.
Oh, so that's an important point.
I want to buy her in the world, but if you can't afford it...
Do you? You don't know her yet.
I don't know yet.
Okay. I think there's another important thing we have to learn from Rabbi Akiva, and that is that it's very important to express what you want. The Gemara says we're supposed to learn from a peacock. The peacock, when it wants to mate, it spreads out all its wings, and our sages say that there's a conversation between the male peacock and the female peacock. He spreads out all his wings and he says, you see how beautiful this is? I'm going to make you a beautiful fur coat. I promise I will make you a fur coat. And she says, yeah, okay, then you could come. And then they mate. And afterwards he bows out and he apologizes. He says, but I can't. So our sages say, what do we learn from the peacock? That there's an importance to the promise. There's an importance to the expression to the woman, I would give you the world if I could. The sincere expression that says, if only I could, I will. And whatever I will be able to do, I will do. And that's very important. Like there was a rabbi whose wife once asked him, we haven't had enough time together. I want you to cancel all your classes for today, and we should spend the time together. So he said, you know, you're right. We haven't had enough time together. I think it makes sense. You're right. It's more important we have time together. What the foundation of everything I do, all the teachings I do, everything I do is based on our relationship. You know that you're number one. There's nothing more important than our relationship. Fine, I'll cancel everything for today. He's thinking inside himself. He's thinking, how can I do it? What does she want? I don't get it. Second later, she says, fine, go teach. I just had to feel like you'd be willing to cancel everything for me.
That's scary. That's gambling.
Huh?
That's like gambling.
It's not like gambling. It's not like gambling because he was right. He was right. If she feels she needs that, then he better know to give it to her. Because if he doesn't, then her happiness is his happiness. And her happiness is the foundation for everything he does. So that doesn't mean that you always have to give in on everything. Obviously, this was a rabbi who was putting in hours. He was getting home at 12, 1 o'clock at night every day. And she was the one who was supporting all this emotionally and in every other aspect. So if once she says, I need the day for myself... So then he better give it to her. We're not talking that every time a wife wants to go out to Beis Medrash, she says, okay, stay here. So then he has to figure out how to make her happy and go to Beis Medrash. both are his responsibilities. But the wisdom of the rabbi was that he knew to tell her, I'll do it. And a person has to be smart to always tell his wife, if she wants something, the first thing he says is, I want to give it to you. And he has to express it not just as, I want to give it to you, but sometimes he should say, okay. The next thing he should say is, you know, we're sort of living off my salary, and if I just take off a day like that, and I have no good reason, I'm not sure it's going to work. Let's think out how we could make it work. Not, this isn't going to work. She wants it, I want it too. The first expression has to be, you want the intimacy, I want the intimacy too. I want it. Now let's think how it's going to work. Now we might reach the conclusion that practically it's not going to work, and then we'll both reach the conclusion that I'm not going to do it. But that's step number two. Step number one is, I agree. I also want it. Questions still here? Okay, so we're out of time. You guys are missing supper already.